to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. It's Voss Group time again. My name is Camden Busey. I'm back, of course, with Lane Tipton, who serves as pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Lane. It's always good to see you.
Camden, it's always great to be with you. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. It's been a while since we've had Voss Group for various reasons. People might know. Who knows? We've been busy with a conference and other stuff going on. A lot of stuff going on, but we're working today to get back into Voss's book, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. We're working through the Banner of Truth edition if we're working on page numbers so you can follow along. Any edition is good. If you got a first edition from Erdmann's, one of those, it's fine, but our page numbers are coming from the Banner of Truth edition, which looks like this if you're watching the video, or the newer one. Down here, my computer screen's in the way, but you can see it right there in the screen. So today we're firing up and going to be working on pages 220, possibly through 224. Every week, every time we do this, I always set out a goal, and we'll see if we can match it. Most of the time, we don't get through much material. But today we're looking at Revelation through showing and seeing. At least to begin there. So again, we're speaking about the mode of reception of the prophetic revelation, looking specifically in the Old Testament. And we know that God has revealed himself in many different ways. And today we're focusing on the ways in which God makes himself known through showing himself and through seeing, namely visions. So that maybe not have been the first thing you thought of when you got up today. And it's not something of our daily experience, per se, seeing visions and having dreams from the Lord. If you're having visions, maybe go to your doctor. If you're having some wild dreams, reconsider your diet. But nevertheless, we are going to consider these as they pertain to the real ways that God has revealed himself in the past. He's spoken. You know, he's given his climactic word to us in Jesus Christ now. So we don't have the need for further inscripturated words, for further dreams and visions and those sorts of things. And so having a healthy understanding of progressive revelation helps us understand what God was doing in the Old Testament. So we're getting into this today. A couple things to mention before we do get started, though. You can visit us online at reformedforum.org. Of course, there you'll find information about all of our programs, but you also find our current products and whatnot going on. I'm going to have some deals coming out eventually, some bundles and things available for the holiday season. So take a look at that and keep your eye on the website. And one of the things there, of course, is our Foundations of Covenant Theology course, a 12-week video course that Lane taught down in Wimberley, Texas. We had such a wonderful time recording down there, and that course has now been made available. A lot of you have picked it up, and you can download it immediately. You just go buy it there in the store, and you'll get download links to 12 high-quality, high-definition videos, as well as PDF notes, outlines, and even some closed caption files that you can plug into your player. And I'm still working on, I don't have the DVDs ready yet, but it's in the works. It's going to take some time. It's more complicated than you think. But I'm working at it and trying to get that done. And Lane, I want to take the opportunity just very briefly. I know you got a lot on your plate, but you have been working on turning this material into a standalone book. It could be used in addition to the course as a helper to the course, but at least that's on the horizon. How soon remains to be seen, but it's definitely something in your pipeline, isn't it?
Yeah, Camden, what I'd like to do, the Wimberley material gets us through some of the material in Genesis, but because of the limitation of time, I wasn't able to give as full and robust an expansion of it as it moves out of Genesis into other epochs in the history of special revelation. What I'd like to do in book form is try to give something of a comprehensive overview of what I'd like to call the history of heaven. And I previewed some of that material in a synoptic form at the conference in October. And I think if I were able to finish that within the next month to 6 weeks, I'm really closing in on trying to finish that up. It would be a short, fairly popular volume, as popular as it can be given the content.
Popular level, you mean? You're not having a vision of the commercial success of your...
Oh yeah, no. I don't even think about that. But popular in terms of accessibility,
Right. Sure.
hopefully, fairly accessible, and so it would be something that helps those who are listening to the Wimberly material recognize a basic thesis that the history and advancement of heaven is of primary concern when you're thinking about the history of the covenant of works on earth and its fruition, and the connection between heaven and earth, and the relationship between heaven's history and earth's history. The volume would make clearer and give a kind of comprehensive bird's eye overview, incorporate some of the themes of the mountain of God material, and hopefully then serve as a companion that gives something of the rest of the story, to pull a Paul Harvey here, something of a kind of additional bird's eye overview of what was not covered in those lessons. And so I think it would be a helpful companion volume that would give interested people who want more. And so I'm going to do my best to try to get that done before Christmas time rolls around, get it to you, and then we can see however long it takes to get it out. I'd like to do that as quickly as possible in the very near future.
Excellent. Yep. And I'll typeset that and get it going ASAP after it's edited and checked and indexed and referenced, all that kind of stuff. So we'll work at it. And just to whet the appetite of all the listeners and viewers, stay tuned, and we hope to have that out. We know people learn in different ways. That's kind of the wonder of humanity. Some people are visual learners. Some people learn, you know, through hearing auditorily. Nevertheless, others prefer the book to sit and read. So at least with this course, we have video. We have excellent audio with the video. And we also have handouts, outlines. And then if a book is to come very soon, I mean, we've got the whole thing there all wrapped up into one. So we look forward to that getting out there and more people learning these important lessons. So let's turn our attention then to the matters at hand today as we open up Voss's book, Biblical Theology, looking at page 220, Revelation Through Showing and Seeing. Now, you've got a representative text. Would you prefer me to read this here from Isaiah 6? Or do you want to start us off and give a brief introduction?
Yeah, just in the briefest of introductions, Voss is moving from the rather extensive discussion we had, Revelation Through Speech and Hearing, to Revelation Through Showing and Seeing. And he makes a comment on the top portion of page 221 that in some cases, the visionary mode of receiving a message or seeing in terms of a vision would belong to the introductory act of the prophet's career. And so he gives several examples of visions being recorded of the canonical prophets: Isaiah 6, Jeremiah 1, Ezekiel 1 through 3, Daniel 2, 7, 8, 10, 11, 12, Amos 7, 8, Zechariah 1, 8, and 6, 1 through 8. And I thought, Camden, what we could do is begin with Isaiah's vision, Isaiah 6, 1 through 7, because it serves a couple of purposes. It helps us see an inaugural episode of Isaiah's ministry as a prophet, and that ministry begins in a visionary mode, in the revelation of God through, quite clearly here, through showing and seeing the Lord. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord himself sitting on a throne. And so maybe that would be helpful, and we could talk about something of the dynamic and realistic character of the vision of the thing seen. And then we can move from that into a discussion of the mode of prophetic revelation through seeing, through showing, through vision, and draw some more implications out of that. So yeah, if you would, I think Isaiah 6, 1 through 6,
sure,
or 1 through 7 would be useful. And then we could just make a few comments about that text.
Yeah, reading the text, it says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.
Yeah, now, Camden, as we look at that vision, here's what we need to appreciate. Voss actually brings this text in. I don't want to confuse our readers, but later, particularly when we get to Revelation through rapture, Voss is going to bring this text into view. But I think it's a helpful text for this reason. If you think about the content of this vision, you have to recognize that if Isaiah had been brought to the temple on God's holy hill, Mount Zion, and if he had by any way had access into the most holy place and inquired into that temple, which only the priests once a year had access to, what he would have seen would have been an earthly replica, a copy, according to texts that present the tabernacle or temple as a replica or copy of heaven. He would have seen the Ark of the Covenant. He would have seen the outstretched wings of cherubim carved by the hands of men. What he would have seen, in other words, would be an inert, immobile, non-living, carved, hammered, forged copy of heaven, of those super sensible things in the heavenly temple. But what he sees instead, and note that verb there in 6:1, I saw, what did he see? Well, he saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe fills the temple. And above him stood living seraphim, crying out in worship with wings that cover eyes and wings that cover face and feet and so on, calling to one another antiphonally, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. Heaven and earth, the whole earth is full of his glory. So here's what we have to start to recognize. In a prophetic vision, when a prophet sees something, the things that are veiled in an invisible heavenly realm are in some form or mode made visible to the prophet. Now, the forms in which these things are made visible, we're going to look in details, and some of it seems arcane. I understand that. But the point that has to be grasped about the visionary mode of revelation is this, that invisible heavenly realities are brought before the vision of the prophet, so that Isaiah is not doing what Aaron would do, looking at the copies of the things in heaven. He's not doing what Moses would do, or even a high priest serving in the first temple would do. He's not looking at those copies. He's seeing, whether it's in the inner eye of the soul or with the outer physical eye, Voss is going to talk about, he's seeing actual heavenly realities, living seraphim, the Lord God himself enthroned in glory upon a throne with the train of his robe filling a temple not made with hands. But as Isaiah 66:1 says, heaven is my throne. He's actually seeing super sensible heavenly things.
Lane, and I think, you know, up until, well, who knows when, but when I was much younger, you know, you'd read something like that, and I never really formed an explicit thought per se, but the assumption always was kind of like, this is almost like a Kantian critical subject. Like, what Isaiah was seeing was dependent on him observing it, or this vision was being produced by the Lord for Isaiah's purpose, but that I didn't have the thought that this is a permanent reality that ongoes with its own, or that's ongoing with its own activity, independent of Isaiah witnessing it. And that's a real revolutionary thought to think about this, that, you know, Isaiah could not see these things before, but that doesn't mean that they didn't exist before Isaiah saw
it. That is precisely the point. It's an astonishing thing, because you could think of it this way, that from the absolute beginning, just to think about Isaiah 6 and to think about this mode of showing and seeing, think of it this way, because this is very fair. This dovetails with things that we've talked about in previous episodes, the conference, and a host of other insights that we've tried to develop. But in the absolute beginning, in Genesis 1:1, when God created the highest heaven, the heaven of heavens, as a temple dwelling, and filled it with angels, from the absolute beginning, the seraphim have been encircling him and worshiping him in precisely this way. And when the Lord finished the 6 days of creation and ascended to sit on his throne, as it were, and enter into that heavenly temple, they surround him who is seated on that throne as the Omega, as the Alpha Creator and the Omega Consummator. And Isaiah is brought in to see just a cross section of that ongoing, uninterrupted, and what we could call eternal worship in heaven. He's brought into that so that it's not just a disclosure of something unique and happening only at that moment just for Isaiah, but it's Isaiah being brought into a heavenly reality that has been ongoing since the absolute beginning and will know no end. He now is brought to see that which is veiled from his sight ordinarily. And so the idea there of revelation through showing and seeing once again brings into view what? The primacy of the history of heaven. And Camden, yeah, it's got a revolutionary dimension to it, because it's not that God reveals something that is fresh and new and unique just for Isaiah. It's that he's disclosing something for Isaiah to see that is a common, uninterrupted, ongoing reality in heaven.
Right.
Which Isaiah then is given eyes to see.
Yeah, it's not as if the Lord says, all right, seraphim, you know, get on your marks. Mm-hmm. Everybody ready? Action. Okay, let's call Isaiah in. You know, this is how the Lord's worship being worshiped all the time in heavenly places.
Yes. And so the point that just to begin here is that this visionary mode of revelation is a mode that ultimately has in view bringing a people to a time when they will see this uninterrupted for themselves, but giving them a glimpse of that which awaits them. So for Isaiah, this isn't the consummation of the ages at the return of Christ, but it's something like what that consummation will look like. The church will be brought into that heavenly temple dwelling to see the glory of the triune God reflected off of the face of the ascended Christ. And the church, bodily, will join with the angels and the seraphim in the worship of God. Revelation 4 picks up on Isaiah 6 and says precisely that thing characterizes the worship in heaven right now, and will characterize the worship in heaven for ages to come. What is it? Being brought into heaven and given what? Eyes that see, ears that hear, minds that understand this glory of God in heaven. And so it really is, Isaiah 6, a very useful kind of template for us to appreciate the nature of this seeing and showing the revelation that God gives by virtue of now seeing, of showing something to see. Now, there's more to be said here. Numbers 12:6, Voss points out, and this is at the top of page 221. Voss says that Numbers 12:6 becomes a kind of a template of sorts for understanding prophets. If there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. So that vision and dream, word of Jehovah and frequent vision become very close to synonyms. There's something kind of dreamlike about the visions that God gives the prophets. And for visions proper, and Camden, our listeners are going to find this, I hope they're going to find it useful. It's certainly a bit more arcane, and we're pushing boundaries of human understanding. I just want everyone to know that. And we're speaking just up to the limits of what God has revealed and trying not to move beyond those limits. But Voss has a section where he talks about the, from pages 221 to 222, about the nature of the objects that the prophets perceive. And here's a kind of formulaic way of summarizing it, and then we can go and talk about this. He says, in visions, prophets perceive a super sensible world as that super sensible world, and by that he means the world beyond sensation, the world beyond what you can see, hear, or smell, or touch in this present dimension of what Klein would call the lower register. Realities of a super sensible, or to use more common parlance, heavenly world, are momentarily brought within the range of the prophet's sight. That's the core. If everything else is lost on us as we're working through this very difficult material, just remember this, that visionary revelation is God bringing a super sensible, that is, heavenly world, a world hidden from ordinary sight, momentarily within the range of the prophet's sight. And so this is really helpful, and I'll just make this point, and then Camden, we might want to discuss this as we preface some of the more distinct material Voss is getting into. But this is, once again, a death knell to theological liberalism. Why? What is a prophet seeing or being shown according to the traditional liberal model? At very best, he's reflecting upon his own experience or the experience of others. In the nature of the case in theological liberalism, there is no super sensible heavenly world. There is no supernatural realm from which God is speaking and by which he is showing through symbols and supernatural communications things that image or reveal heavenly realities. At very best, what the liberal tradition is giving you is reflection upon the religious experience in this world of a given community. So for Voss to emphasize revelation through showing and seeing, and for him to define a vision proper as a momentary disclosure of a super sensible heavenly reality, that is once again 180 degrees turn from what the liberal tradition would be telling you, which is to say what the prophet is being shown or what he's seeing, it's really nothing more than a microcosm of his own mind, of his own experience, or the experience of his contemporaries. And so a visionary mode of revelation is a temporary granting of access to a heavenly or supersensible reality. And I think that needs to be appreciated. If you don't appreciate that, this is going to sound really abstract and almost like some could say, why are we even thinking about this? Well, it's absolutely critical because it brings into view the vertical, supernatural, intrusionary character of visionary revelation, right? It's an actual disclosure to the prophet of something, of a realm of created reality called heaven that transcends human knowledge and investigation in the nature of the case. It's hidden from sight. So I hope that helps our listeners say, we need to talk more about this, because otherwise it could sound like we're just engaging in unusual speculation. No, this is an intrinsic component of the supernatural, vertical, intrusionary character of revelation that the prophet receives in a vision.
Yeah, I think that's really quite useful. And it orients our minds correctly so as we can think about these realities. That's what they are, the realities, things that really exist in a proper way. And so it's interesting. I mean, even you mentioned how vision gets linked up with revelation more generally. It's not to say it's the only form of revelation, but even Isaiah 1, the book opens, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos. But there's so much of the book that can't be encapsulated within the literal explicit, you know, understanding, the narrow understanding of a vision per se, but it's meant to show how this here is a revelation, and the whole book is revelation, but specifically, and there's many important visions given to Isaiah, and so that is a world of difference from what the liberals believe.
Yeah, yeah. What he saw, not the whole book isn't a vision, but the visions that are given are synonymous with revelation received outside of himself, given by God supernaturally. And one great illustration of this, Camden, is the 2 Kings 6:17 text with Elisha. If you have that, could you read the whatever context you think is appropriate to let this truth be clear to the listeners? But 2 Kings 6:17 in context is very useful to make this very point that we're making about the the temporary granting of access to what is presently veiled to ordinary physical sight.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll back up just for a second. But looking at 2 Kings 6:15, when the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" He said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Please strike this people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. So similar thing, that there is a reality, there's something that exists prior to a person witnessing it, even though it's there, so to speak. And then the Lord opens their eyes.
Yes, and that is so important here. The Lord opens eyes to see an entire existing dimension of a hidden heavenly host surrounding the people of God, surrounding and bringing protection to those who by ordinary sight seem vastly outnumbered. And so this is a granting of vision into things hidden from sight. And so it's not that the prophets get a purely symbolic insight. Rather, it is insight into a supernatural, supersensible, presently existing dimension of reality that's simply not accessible by ordinary sight. And so that raises this question. And this is where I think our listeners, if they were reading through this in advance, were reading along and saying, What am I looking at here? Voss says that the nature of this vision forces us to make a distinction with regard to how the prophets would have seen this vision. And I'm going to use some illustrations that Voss doesn't include here to try to make it helpful. But on page 222 if you will look at the about midway down the page, Voss talks about a distinction that is useful for trying to understand how a prophet would see these visions. And that distinction is between, quote, the things thrown upon the screen of inner vision. He says they might have been psychical reproductions, portraits of the reality submitted, or they may have been symbolic figures shadowing the realities but not copying them. Now, I just want our listeners, this might be semi-humorous. I remember the first time I read that when I was in seminary, and I marked it with a question mark. I put a question. I said, what in the world is he talking about? I really truly didn't know. And over the years, as we've taught through this and thought through this, Camden, I think it's become clearer to us. And Camden, I'd love your input and insight on this, but let me try to make that distinction as clear as I think we can make it, and use one illustration for each. And then Camden, feel free to tweak it and say, Lane, I think there are better illustrations to use, and turn us in a different direction, because this is one of the more difficult areas to try to render this clear. But when he talks about things that might be psychical reproductions, portraits of the reality submitted, I think it would be something like this, that sometimes the prophet is given a vision of something that replicates an existing heavenly reality. And that would be, I think, in a case like, think of Psalm 11:4 and Isaiah 66:1. What is heaven? The invisible heavens? It's a temple. The Lord's throne is in his temple, and heaven is my throne. The earth is my footstool. Now, when a prophet receives a vision or is shown something, a great illustration of this, I think, would be in Exodus 25:40, where God shows Moses the pattern on the mountain of the tabernacle he is to create on earth. And what is that reality according to Hebrews 8:5? It is heaven itself. It is an unveiling of an archetypal temple, and Moses is to make the earthly reality a copy or a shadow of the heavenly things. So when a prophet is thinking about heaven, what image is he going to be thinking about? He's going to be thinking about that earthly copy. And that earthly copy can then become a kind of portrait of the heavenly reality. So when in a vision, God shows a prophet a temple, and it's a temple that's being measured, it's a temple that water's flowing out of, like Isaiah, Ezekiel 47 and other texts like that, what's being shown to the prophet is, in many instances, a psychical reproduction or a portrait of the heavenly thing, and that would be something like the thing on earth. I hope this is useful. Now, I may be missing something here, Camden, so you feel free to amplify this. But in visions, when a temple is portrayed with water flowing from it, like with Ezekiel, it's often going to be the case that the earthly copy, the portrait, is what is being used to represent the heavenly original, where God dwells amidst the seraphim and now the spirits of the righteous departed. But the you could also be thinking of symbolic figures shadowing but not copying the things that they represent. The best illustration I could come up with here, Camden, and I'm not sure it's the best that could be come up with, it's just one that I was thinking through. Think of the beasts in Daniel's vision. In Revelation, in Daniel's vision, Daniel 7, Daniel 9, the beasts in Daniel's vision are symbolic figures that are not true copies of anything on earth, but what do they represent? They represent earthly kingdoms.
Right.
Persian kingdom, Roman kingdom. But what are their, what do they look like? Well, they have the face of a man and the wings of a bird. There's a rough, strong beast with iron teeth trampling everything under it that many think would be a reference to Rome. What you have there are symbolic realities, symbolic images, but they shadow but do not copy what they're representing. They're a shadowy, visionary, apocalyptic expression of something that's true of what it's imaging, what it's talking about, namely the Empire of Rome. But it's not a one-to-one correspondence. It's not a copy. It's not like an earthly replica of a heavenly reality. It's more like an apocalyptic image of a nation. And I think that what Voss is saying is that of the sorts of things that prophets see in visions, they're either seeing things that are like portraits of things in heaven, copies, earthly temple, heavenly temple, or they're seeing apocalyptic images like the beasts that Daniel sees that are actually shadowy representations of earthly kingdoms. And this is why Voss is saying that we have to recognize that there's a flexibility and a diversity to the things that are seen and to the things that are shown. And we have to have awareness of that and be attuned to it. That's what I think he's after. Now, what do you think? Do you think there are other illustrations that might be useful? Or,
maybe.
I want all our listeners to know.
Sure.
I'm a little tentative in, I think I could say more. I think you could say more. But I'm trying to be as clear as I can be on something that's difficult.
Well, I think to start, do a little exegesis on Voss here.
Yeah.
To start, I think reproductions and copying are linked. So when he says, even here a distinction is possible, the things thrown upon this screen, so the illustration he's given is like a projection, projector. We have those in evangelical churches, right? Used to have overhead projectors in classrooms. But you have things thrown upon the screen would be like the screen of Isaiah's mind or the prophet's mind. Might have been psychical reproduction. So psychical would have to do with the soul, psuche. Reproduction, so that is a copy or a clone. So it could be something that he's seeing is somehow like a little copy of it is made in the prophet's inner person so they could perceive it with the mind's eye, so to speak, mm-hmm. in their soul. Mm-hmm. So, and then he says, portraits of the reality submitted. So that's epexegetical of the psychical reproduction. It's another way to say it. Portraits of the reality. So there are heavenly realities and that God might be issuing portraits in the prophet's mind that help him to understand what those things are, though he's not directly perceiving them. Doesn't make what he's seeing false, but he's seeing it through a lens that because what actually exists is imperceptible to a non-glorified person. Continuing, or they may have been symbolic figures shadowing forth the realities, but not copying them. I don't know exactly what he's saying there, but I think what he's making the difference, you know, it's somewhat maybe an epistemological difference. On the one hand, you have God making a representation, a true veritable representation of something, but a representation, so to speak, and implanting it within the soul of the prophet, the inner person. On the other hand, you merely have a projection that is not, it's veiled, it's not immediate, so it's not immediately perceptible, but it's not a copy. So I think here's the difference. And again, we don't have Voss here to ask him the question, but I think the difference he's getting at is when you have a copy, like you use the illustration of the temple. Once the temple copy is made, it's related to the heavenly reality, but it has its own independent timeline, its own independent history. But when we're thinking of a shadow is not exactly the reality, but the shadow has no, a shadow, you know, being cast by an object, has no independent existence once the shadow appears. It only exists in tandem with and in constant connection with the other thing. So in one sense, the shadow is kind of it's a projection, but it's not a copy because it has no independent existence anymore. So maybe the difference here is Voss is saying, I don't know, because this is the mind of a prophet and I'm not given much more information, but he's saying, I don't know whether these things are some sort of like mental soul-ish copies that God plants in the person so they can understand something new and true that is beyond their ability to experience otherwise, or whether this God is somehow allowing something to press through this membrane that exists between the heavenly places, the invisible heavens and the visible earth. Yeah. But you can imagine like a veil, and then somebody like putting their hand or their face through the veil. You don't actually see them, but you don't see them as if you were standing in front of them face to face, but through a veil, you still have a perception of them and the shape and contours of somebody. Maybe he's talking about something like that. But that shape and the contour, that projection, doesn't exist without that real thing being projected into the other space. So that's a long answer that is just a tentative guess at what he's saying. Yeah. Maybe it doesn't matter.
Well, it does seem to be that the replication, the psychical reproduction, the reproduction in the mind or inner soul of the prophet as a portrait of the thing. As you've said that, Camden, let me try it this way. Perhaps that's the hupadegmati of Hebrews 8:5.
Sure.
That the tabernacle is a instantiated copy of the thing in heaven. And when God is revealing the glory of the temple to the prophets, there could be a sense in which the replica is placed in its form as a replica, as something that's copying formally that thing above. Yet at the same time, it could be a shadow, because it's a symbolic. There could be a symbolic impression given to the prophet,
right,
that doesn't yet take that form that copies yet. It is the reality pressing down upon him in a perhaps less precise form. So maybe it's from the more precise portrait dimension to the less precise shadowing down dimension. Mm-hmm. And the correspondence very roughly could be the difference between how an earthly temple copies heaven and a beast that has the face of an ox represents a given earthly kingdom. There wouldn't be as much a one-to-one correspondence as archetype to ectype as you have in the psychical reproduction of the portrait. You wouldn't have that as much in the symbolic figure that shadows down the reality without copying it in a more formally precise way. Yeah. Maybe that's what he's after.
Well, I think, to talk in terms of metaphysics or ontology, perhaps the copy, the reproduction, becomes its own quid. Yeah. Now, even if it's a psychical impression or a psychical reproduction, it still has its own, it is an existent. It exists.
Yeah.
Whereas the shadow, it's a thing, it's perceptible, but it's relative in the sense that it is the original, it's just being perceived in a different way.
Yeah, it's a perceptual difference, right, of the same thing.
Right.
So, that's why I'm saying this is a difficult area, and Camden, I think you've added some clarity. Personally, I think that's a wonderful explanation of just trying to get into the ballpark.
But even at the end of the day, Voss doesn't seem to be settled. He says it could be either of these. He's just raising the question.
Yes, and he does say, that particularly that the last sentence of that section on revelation through showing and seeing, this should guide what you and I were after just now, talking about some very difficult things. The whole region is a field of mystery, and other processes than we can imagine may have characterized it. So I just want to emphasize again how tentative I'm being at trying to explain this, but I do want to accent that I think you added some clarity that's very useful, and we're taking steps in the right direction and probably stopping about where Voss would want us to stop. But now the additional point here, Camden, and we can move through this fairly quickly. Voss makes a distinction, and you've already made this, so I think it might be just a distinction we make quickly and then move on to a third option and then talk about bodily effects if we have time to finish this up. But he distinguishes between seeing a vision with the external bodily eye on the one side and the inner field of vision, the inner eye or the soul eye, as the organ of vision on the other side. And a supernatural object outside of the prophet could be seen in one of two ways. It could be seen with the physical eye, just as we see objects outside of us that God makes clear to us and makes known to us. Or it could be seen with the inner eye, the eye of the soul, and not with the physical eye. Now, a lot of people might think that's speculative. How can you make such a distinction? Let me give just the quickest illustration of this that I think might help our listeners. And then Camden, we can expand on it as you see fit. In Hebrews 12, 22 through 24, when the author of Hebrews says, "You have come to the heavenly Jerusalem, to Mount Zion, to the assembly of the firstborn in heaven. You have come to the spirits of the righteous who are made perfect, and you've come to Jesus." The point that's being made there is that you have come to a worship assembly where angels and saints alike are beholding the glory of God in Christ. And so to be away from the body, 2 Corinthians 5:8, is to be at home with the Lord. And being at home with the Lord is likened to an ongoing, uninterrupted worship service where, just as angels see the glory of God without bodies, so likewise the spirits of the righteous are beholding that glory and worshiping God in heaven. Revelation 4 and Revelation 5 picture the worship of those who are in heaven while their bodies are on earth, and they cry out, "Worthy is the Lamb, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty." And they see the glory of the Lamb, but their seeing is with what Voss is calling here the inner field of vision, the inner eye or the soul eye. And what's being said here is that in various situations, the prophet could either see and be shown something with the physical eye, or see and be shown something with that inner soul eye or with a perceptual organ that is not tied to the body. And I think that distinction is a helpful distinction, and we have to recognize that either or both could be the case.
Sure. And so, yeah, to go along with the fact that angels see and behold, you can just also point to the fact that there are visions, local visions given to people in the Bible. We read of Elisha and his servant, where one person in the same location could see a reality and the other couldn't until their eyes were opened. And I think a more natural way, a more simple way to read that, is not that the other person had their physical eyes inhibited, but that the Lord had not granted the perception to them. And so to me, that seems to lean toward the fact that there is some sort of soul eye, or that the Lord is conveying these invisible realities to somebody in an immediately perceptible way, but not through the normal physics of light reflecting off of objects and being received in our eyeballs.
That's precisely the case. And then we've already hit this. So a third option is rapture, which is the Isaiah 6 text, where it's not a descent of heavenly things in symbols or pictures, but an ascent into the heavenly things themselves. And that, I think, is a heightened eschatological movement, that when a prophet is brought up to the glory council of God, brought up to heavenly Mount Zion, brought into the heavenly temple to behold God's glory like Isaiah, it is there that you get a third option of rapture, where the prophet, where images of heaven are not psychically embedded in him, but he is brought to those things that those psychical images represent. And that is a heightened form of visionary revelation. And so really you could say that what Isaiah received, what we opened with, which is this third option of rapture being brought up into the heavenly things themselves, that is an anticipation of the climactic vision of Christ at the end of the age. The Visio Dei, as we've spoken about, is being not beholden of those copies and portraits and symbols, but the reality itself of the living God in heaven, surrounded by seraphim, where Christ now has ascended bodily. That is this heightened revelation through seeing and showing, that Isaiah, in one sense, is a kind of preview of the consummation of the end of the age, really, where the church is brought to see that glory in heaven. And it's not a descending, but an ascending, and an opening to see that ongoing heavenly reality.
Well, let's talk. We've been talking about psychic experiences. So psychic referring to the soul, but Voss then addresses the body and bodily effects from such experiences. What does Voss say on the body with regard to this topic?
Well, just to close out, I know we've been going for a while, but to when he speaks of the ear, there's a waking of the ear, and it doesn't entail that there's an awareness of the external world that disappears and you're hearing something beyond it. It's just a waking of the ear to hear. But with the eye, it's different. He says this, that often, Balaam is an example of this, Numbers 24, 3 and 4, that while Balaam's physical eye was closed, his inner eye was open, and he fell down in that event. Not an act of worship that's voluntary, but a kind of overwhelming of him. So this brings into view that the bodily effect is this, that it seems, Voss is saying, that ordinarily the prophet isn't seeing with physical eyes. The eye closes, the physical eye closes, and the inner eye is opened, so that you see with the eye, as it were, of the soul, superseding the vision that is given with the physical eye. And the bodily effects of this are very interesting. And I guess three things can be said. First, Ezekiel said he was carried to a faraway place, Ezekiel 8:3, lifted up between heaven and earth and brought to Jerusalem. Voss says that's highly unlikely that this was a physical transportation, but more of a taking of Isaiah's soul, that inner eye, to a place where he could see the temple. And I think it might be debatable whether or not it was bodily. But the point I wanted to drive to was that Voss notes that in the vision, there are two kinds of responses. The first one, in the case of Daniel, is there was bodily discomfort and sickness for days. Daniel 7:28 and 8:27. In other words, it's a very traumatic thing to have a vision, and especially if it's an apocalyptic vision of judgment and curse.
Not your everyday experience.
Yeah. Right. So
you might be shaken up by that.
Yeah. It brought lasting sickness and shaken up. But but to end on a high note here, Jeremiah 31:26, the prophet says, given the vision that the Lord showed him in Jeremiah 31, "At this I awoke and looked, and my sleep was pleasant to me." So there's a sense in which the bodily function of this visionary mode of knowing and showing and seeing brings great comfort to the prophet. Camden, if you could, just in terms of trying to explain that briefly, that the vision brings great delight, could you read Psalm Jeremiah 31, yeah. 6, 12 through 14, just to give a sense of what brought him comfort as he was shown and saw the things that were to come in the fullness of the new covenant?
Mm-hmm. Jeremiah 31, 6, "For there shall be a day when watchmen will call in the hill country of Ephraim, arise and let us go up to Zion, to the Lord our God." Then verse 12, "They shall come and sing aloud on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the goodness of the Lord, over the grain, the wine, and the oil, and over the young of the flock and the herd. Their life shall be like a watered garden, and they shall languish no more." And then 13 and 14, "Then shall the young women rejoice in the dance, and the young men and the old shall be merry. I will turn their mourning into joy. I will comfort them and give them gladness for sorrow. I will feast the soul of the priests with abundance, and my people shall be satisfied with my goodness, declares the Lord."
See, that text, when you look down to Jeremiah 31, 25, and 26, it says this, "For I will satisfy the weary soul, and every languishing soul I will replenish." And then he says, "At this I awoke and looked, and my sleep was pleasant to me." This brings into view what the author of Hebrews makes clear in Hebrews 12, 22 through 24, that the wilderness church already now comes to Mount Zion, ascends that mountain in corporate worship, and finds in Jesus Christ the satisfaction of God's goodness, receives comfort, mourning is turned into joy, gladness is exchanged for sorrow in union and communion with the ascended Christ. And when these sorts of things were disclosed to the prophet, the bodily effect on him was sweet and pleasant sleep. The point here is that in these visions, there was great trauma in the case of Daniel, sickness in the case of Daniel, particularly with some of the apocalyptic judgment motifs that he witnessed. But also, and this is the note for the New Covenant community, wilderness community in union with the ascended Christ, there was also great sleep and comfort and joy for the prophet who saw these things from afar and welcomed them. And so when we're thinking along these lines, then the thing to appreciate is that there, and to summarize, is that against the liberal tradition, there is an actual inbreaking and communication in portrait and symbol form, in visionary visual form of the glory of the things to come, the glory of God in judgment and in salvation, judgment of his enemies, salvation of his people, as that judgment precedes mercy, as that judgment provides the context for the salvation of God's people. And these visions introduce a heavenly world not accessible by sense organs and bring the prophet into a momentary, temporary contact with those heavenly things. And here's the connection: what is momentary and temporary for the prophet at a distance is coming to be the constant and uninterrupted thing that the church now accesses in union with Christ, now by faith, and in the age to come, what is veiled to sight in this age will be open permanently to sight in the age to come. And those things temporarily held on to, temporarily seen, temporarily experienced through the copies, the portraits, or the shadows, the heavenly reality itself comes to be the abiding possession of the church in union with Christ. And so there's a sense in which there's a I don't know, I don't want to call it this, but a relative primacy to the showing and viewing, because what is being shown, what is being viewed are the heavenly things that are the everlasting inheritance of the church as she comes to possess God and his glory and fellowship in those heavenly places in Christ Jesus. And so this is just one more way of Voss reminding us of the otherworldly heavenly character of prophetic revelation as it stands over against any kind of eminentizing, desupernaturalizing trend of historic liberalism. Once again, the realism of heaven in the mode of showing and seeing comes to be something that's the province of reformed biblical theology. The supernaturalism of the Christian religion is writ large here.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. It sure is. No, I appreciate that. And thanks for opening this up for us today and talking about these matters.
No, thank you, Camden.
November, we had a lot of material from our conference in October, and Lane was able to speak on the history of heaven with connection to that material. But to get back into the actual book here, Voss's Biblical Theology, it's always a pleasure. And you know, I have a lot of listeners who are always looking forward to this. So hopefully be back on the weekly schedule. Hopefully see a lot more from you in terms of writing and other opportunities. And if people have any questions, you can, or if they want to catch up, you can head on over to reformedforum.org. I have a pretty big web refresh, you know, planned. It's going to take me some time, but I hope to revamp the navigation of the website quite a bit, make it a lot simpler to find things like this, like the whole Voss Group collection. And if you want to catch up, all the episodes are there. They're all available. You can download them from the archive, and you get all 59 of them or however many there are, and catch up. We're only doing about 3 or 4 pages a month, so it won't take you too long. But if you got any questions or any other thoughts, you can email us at mail@reformedforum.org. You can tweet us at Reformed Forum, Facebook page, Facebook group, all those places too. We're available, and we appreciate your support and your encouragement. We do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.